listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
So, what is rebel music, and who are the musicians, artists, and activists behind it? Where is it being made, and how does it reflect the politics of the Muslim youth movement? In his new book, author Hisham Aidi takes us on a fascinating ride through history and global politics, race relations, and an analysis of our contemporary moment as being defined by Muslim youth here and abroad. Music, of course, is the lens through which we learn about what's coming out of the favelas in Brazil, the ghetto outside of Paris, urban centers in Morocco, or even here at home in Philly. Aidi writes, as participant, journalist, and scholar, whether this uptown Berber, which is the name of his Twitter handle, is on the ground at hip-hop festivals, speaking the language of music makers, or providing historical perspective, he gives the reader a deft analysis of how pop culture, underground movements, and a long history of cross-cultural exchange all contribute to this present-day search by Muslim youth to find their non-racist utopia. Rebel music is layered and complex, and the narrative shares the same rich nuance as does the music with which Aidi cites. We'll learn about the Nawa reggae music coming out of Northern Africa, and we'll be introduced to the Brazilian frenzy for all things Turkish, thanks to the popular Brazilian soap opera Salva Jorge. From Chicago's Southside Hip Hop Festival to the US diplomatic response to courting foreign minorities through music, I don't doubt that you're going to enjoy this journey through Aidi's soundtrack of the global youth movement unfolding here and abroad. Author Hisham Aidi is a lecturer at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. He was a George Soros OSI Fellow, a Carnegie Scholar with Manning Marable, and was a consultant on the UNDP's Human Development Report. Aidi has been a columnist for Al Jazeera, written for Harvard University's Africana.com, and is co-editor of Black Routes to Islam. In conversation with him tonight is Safa Samizade Yazda, who is visiting us from Colorado. She currently edits the art, culture, and music sections for Aslan Media, an online media source on the Middle East and its global diaspora communities. She is recognized for her cultural reporting on the Egyptian protests in Tahrir Square and her writings on resistant art within Middle East conflict and periphery cultures, and those can be found online at Art 21 and Reorient magazine, as well as with Deutsche Welle's upcoming anthology, Sitting on the Fence, The Role of Media and Conflict. Most recently, Safa co-curated the first festival of Iranian theater to be presented in the United States, which earned recognition in Backstage magazine, the New York Times art section, and NPR's All Things Considered. Please join me in welcoming author Hisham Aidi and Samizade Yazd to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. So this is what I can honestly promise you all to be a very, very stimulating and really exciting lecture hour coming up. Having read this book myself, I was telling Hisham over Skype last week, there are about a handful of books that I cannot loan out to anyone because I've written so many notes in them. This is one of them. And actually, if you can kind of scroll through. So that's actually how just in extensive and really informational this book is. And really what we're going to cover tonight is really just going to scratch the very surface of just the depth of what he wrote about in Rebel Music. So, Hisham Aidi, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
And so I guess we'll just kind of start right off the bat. In lieu of a what did you have for breakfast today question, I wanted to start with you. You had said previously that this book is a culmination of about a decade's worth of research. And your background, you had said also too, is in international policy, economics. And so I kind of wanted to start by asking you, what precipitated your research in this area? And how is that? How did you organize this book to reflect that?
I'd say a couple of things. I'd say around 10 years ago, I was a graduate student working on a dissertation on labor movements, right, and globalization and so on. And I was working. Can you all hear me? Fine. I was working as a journalist based in Harlem, covering Harlem and the Bronx for a couple of magazines, looking at sort of transnationalism, demographic changes, cultural trends in Harlem and the Bronx. And I was noticing youth coming in from around the world going up to the Bronx. Kids coming in from Germany and Brazil and Argentina and France, Muslim, non-Muslim, and going up to the Bronx for the hip-hop concerts, to go visiting Crotona Park, taking the Mambo to Hip-Hop tour, trying to meet with the hip-hop pioneers. That's how I opened the book, right? Sort of being up there talking to a rap trio from Marseille, France. And I became interested in the role of the Bronx, really, in global youth culture today, and the role of African-American culture, hip-hop, and more broadly, the Black Freedom Movement and the cultures that it's inspired around the world. So that's the first thing. The second thing, I was writing a dissertation looking at labor movements in Latin America. So in the early 2000s, I was visiting Latin America, Brazil, Mexico, and so on. And I was struck by how the experience of Muslims in Latin America is radically different from that in North America. Right, being Muslim in South America is different than being a Muslim in North America, Western Europe. Right, here in the mid 2000s, you will remember the discourse with us against us. Every television show is either Jack Bauer, Sleeper Cell. You know, every television show that has to do with Islam has to do with terrorism. Being in Brazil doing research back then was different. It was like being in a spa, honestly. You know, the discourse on Islam is radically different. You know, Islam is, you know, solidarity with the Muslim world. This is an interesting part of the world. It's exotic. It's, you know, it's enriching and so on. And so it's those two things, right? So I started writing about sort of politics in Brazil and so on. And from there, I was working sort of, working as a journalist, writing different pieces while working on my dissertation. When you're working on a dissertation, everything else is interesting, obviously, right? So once that was done, I turned my attention to some music and politics, and I thought music would be an interesting way to look at the emerging youth movements, Muslim youth movements around the world, for various reasons which we can talk about.
Mm-hmm. And you had just talked about Brazil, how it's a spa, pretty much. So let's kind of dive into that, because that's actually where the book, after you talk about the Bronx, that's actually kind of where the book starts with the first chapter. This is almost like instead of around the world in 80 days, tonight's going to be kind of like around the world in 80 minutes, looking at different parts of the world and youth and different genres of music. So let's start with Brazil. And you were talking about, you talked a bit about in the book about pop Islamophilia and how there's a political element to it in how Brazil has integrated sort of its Islamic past into its national narrative, and then also on the other side of that you have soap operas like El Clone, which instead of villainizing Muslims, it's actually opened up a broad dialogue about it, and it's actually opened up it into the domestic realm in many ways, and how it's held up a mirror to basically how Brazil looks at Muslims as part of the national narrative. And if you could go in more into that.
So I was working as a fellow a few years ago with the George Soros Foundation, and George Soros Foundation has a project called At Home in Europe, on Muslims in Europe, right? And sort of three or four things that we look at, you look at sort of Muslim communities and the challenges they face, and it tends to be state policy, right? Sort of hostile policy, surveillance, and so on. Right-wing movements, right? And then media, right? So these three factors you see in Western Europe and North America, but you don't see in South America, right? And the reason for that is simply that, you know, the situation of Muslims tends to be, in any society in the West, tends to be the result of state policy and geopolitics. And Brazil has made it a point, sort of is made a part of its identity to not be part of U.S. policy or Western policy towards the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia. So Brazilian public diplomacy, Brazilian cultural diplomacy, since the 1930s, has had a very unique approach to the Muslim world and Africa, right? And I begin talking about a gentleman by the name of Gilberto Freire, right, who wrote a book called Casa Grande Senzala, which is about the plantation, which is about slavery in Brazil. But he creates this national mythology about Brazil, saying that Brazil, race relations in Brazil are softer, race relations in Brazil are better. People, this is a mixed society. We should be proud of our mixedness, right? This is the 1930s. He went to Colombia, studied with Franz Boas, and he would say that Brazil gets its tolerance. This is mythology, obviously. It's a national mythology. Brazil gets its tolerance, its métissage, from Islamic Iberia, right? The roots of Brazil begin in Moorish Portugal. So he wrote extensively about this, right? About how, you know, the Portuguese would come to, you know, Brazil, and they would see the indigenous women, and it would remind them of the Morisca, and there's this whole thing of the enchanted Moors as a cultural trope in Brazil. And what happens is Vargas, who was a strong man ruling Brazil in the 40s and 50s, he makes this national policy. Right? He takes the ideas of Freire, right, and the idea of Brazil being of Brazil as a racial democracy, of a country being mixed, linked to Africa and the Orient, and therefore different than the West, not having a colonial mission or an imperial mission, and he entrenches it in cultural policy. Right, so you begin to see from the beginning, right, Brazilian Orientalism is different than that of Western Europe or the United States, British, French, American Orientalism. And it's manifest, right? It's manifest in different pop cultural trends. And what I say in the book is after 9/11, Brazil suddenly experiences this new wave of pop cultural Orientalism, right? And you see it in soap operas, you see it in music, you see it in carnival, where the mulata, the samba queen, is suddenly, you know, tattooed with, you know, Arabic tattoos, and there are these, you know, groups of women called the Habibas who do samba and belly dancing, but there's all kinds of sort of Oriental influence that permeates Brazilian popular culture. And it's, you know, it's facetious in a certain way, but at the same time, Brazil was trying to respond, right, to media flows coming from the U.S., right, because CNN and The New Yorker would start talking about Fojiwasu, a city in eastern Brazil, as being a haven of terrorism. So there's this discourse at the same time that there's a discourse about crime in Brazilian favelas, Brazil as an urban dystopia, the film City of God emerges, becomes popular. So Brazilian media begins pushing back against, you know, these discourses that link Brazil to Islam and terrorism and link the favela to sort of violence and dystopia, right? Creating a new image, right? A new discourse on Islam, right? And that is one of mixedness, of the, you know, of third world solidarity. And you see it in carnival, you see it in music, you see it in dance, and you see it in telenovelas, mm-hmm. right? I don't know how many of you watch Telemundo or Univision, Spanish telenovelas, but telenovelas in the developing world play a very critical role, mm-hmm. right, in stimulating national dialogue and mirroring what's going on in society. And in Brazil, after 9/11, there was a telenovela called O Clone, El Clone, The Clone, that was set to go on air. And it was postponed while the producer decided how to represent Muslims, right? And it ended up being a Brazilian-Moroccan love story. Pop, Orientalist, chic, as you'll see in this upcoming clip, but also with a message behind it, right? And this is the kind of pop Orientalism that you see in southern Brazil, that you see in Carnival, in Rio, and Sao Paulo, right? More on it after the clip, yeah.
All right, so clip one, go. بنا حبيبي مش قال الأوان ويومين من حياتي كانوا فين من زمان بنا حبيبي مش قال الأوان ويومين من حياتي كانوا فين من زمان
That's to lighten the mood a bit. You know, it looks like what it is, pop Orientalist kitsch, right? You know, but this telenovela would be translated into a number of languages, screened in 50 plus countries. It would be used in Portugal to help you know, talk about immigration. It would be used in Kyrgyzstan. It would be used in a number of countries. What is the story about? It's essentially a story about intermarriage, right? Interfaith marriage. And it was airing at the same time as the war on terror is playing out, right? So deliberately, the Brazilian producers would try to offer the opposite sort of representation of Muslims that being seen on CNN or what's the Jack Bauer show called?
24.
And so on, right? So it's about intermarriage. It would contrast the situation of Muslims in Brazil with that of Muslims in the U.S. being surveilled and so on. So there's a very conscious attempt, right, by Brazilian producers, Brazilian media, and the Brazilian state to provide a different, to imagine a different encounter, a different relationship to the Muslim world. And this was part of Lula's diplomacy. Well, Lula made it a point, right? This is important, and there is no theoretical framework driving, you know, this book. But if there is a framework, it is that most of these cultural trends that we're seeing tend to be state-driven, right? In the case of Brazil, Lula made it a point that he would not participate in war on terror policies. Brazil made it a point that they would not pass the region-wide Patriot Act that Rumsfeld wanted. They would not take any of the prisoners from Guantanamo. So Brazil would take the lead in resisting, right, the war on terror policies in the U.S., was implementing. And there's a cultural side to this. That's what's interesting, right? Is that the resistance to war on terror policies had a cultural angle to it. And you saw it in, you know, across Latin America, but especially Brazil, the mix of tropicalism and Orientalism.
And what's interesting is then you contrast that with samba music and sort of this more political take from other parts,
right,
of Brazil, if you could elaborate,
right,
on that.
So what you're seeing here is sort of, you know, Brazil's image of itself. Racial democracy, mixed. We can mix with any part of the world. We can absorb any culture. Gilberto Freire, who I mentioned, says Brazil can ingest any culture and continue to be Brazilian, right? This is the message here. I did research at the Center for the Memory of Carnival, looking at how Carnival would try to do representations. Each float in Brazil is supposed to have an enredo, which is a story. So each enredo would often try to tell a positive story about Dubai or Lebanon or Egypt or northern Nigeria, some part of the Muslim world. Mm-hmm. But this is southern Brazil, right? So these are the representations you see in southern Brazil, the samba queen, scantily clad, and so on. In northern Brazil, there's a different representation of the Islamic world, right? And that's also been emerging in the last 10 years because of state policy, because Lula would mandate that Black history be taught, Black National Conscience Day. And what you're seeing in Brazil with Afro-Brazilian movements, this began before Lula, actually, with the transition to democracy, is you see movements trying to reach back, sort of recuperate the history of African slaves in Brazil, right? And the critical juncture here, the critical memory here, is the Malé uprising of 1835, which was a Muslim slave uprising in Brazil, one of the largest, biggest slave revolts in the New World. It failed. It did not succeed. But the material that the police found afterwards showed that there was extensive Muslim life in Salvador and Pernambuco and northern Brazil, Islamic schools and so on. And the revolt failed, but it would resonate across the Atlantic, in the U.S., in France, in Portugal, in Britain. People were talking about, is this jihad? What's going on here, right? And I talk in the book about how this fear of Muslim slaves goes back to 1492 when Columbus came across, right? And there were cedulas, church decrees that were passed preventing Muslim slaves from coming across the Atlantic. Particularly Moorish slaves, right? Esclavos blancos, white slaves as they're called, because they were seen as they could radicalize the West Africans, right? Some things never change. And so these church decrees were passed, you know, preventing Muslim slaves from coming across, North African slaves. However, exceptions were made for Morisca women who served in brothels, right? This is the 1500s, early 1500s. And so starting in the early 1500s, you have this Orientalist sort of fantasy, you know, King Ferdinand I and then King Charles would give decrees allowing for, so no Muslims could go across, but you can allow Moriscas, Eslavas Blancas, to go across so that Spanish men can have kids with them as opposed to mixing with indigenous women, right? So in this, you begin to see the beginning of this trope of the enchanted Moris and the Morisca and so on. How did I get on this? What did you ask me?
We were talking about northern Brazil versus southern, and then samba school.
Okay, so there's long been this fear of Muslim slaves coming across, right? And what you have in northern Brazil, you have this massive slave uprising, right? Which would affect the thought of Gilberto Freire, one of the most well-known intellectuals, probably the father of Latin American anthropology, the father of Brazilian nationalism in some ways. And, you know, he would write about the impact. He would say, you know, Brazil would get Muslim influence through Moorish Portugal, but also through the Malays, right? And he would talk, he was one of the first to write about this, but if you go to carnival in southern Brazil, it tends to be the scantily clad, naked mulata, right, at carnival, at the floats. Northern Brazil is the baiana, right, who's covered up, right? And he would say, right, this is an Islamic influence, right, sort of the dress and modesty. So the baiana is a figure that you see in Brazilian carnival up in Bahia. And you're going to see in this clip, this is a group called Malé de Balé. Mm-hmm. And from their name, they celebrate the Malés. It's a musical group. It's a bloco afro. It's a small samba school. I interviewed a number of samba schools in northern Brazil. But Malé de Balé are one of the groups that's reaching back and celebrating the uprising and creating a new Brazilian Muslim identity, Afro-Brazilian Muslim identity. You're going to see them, they're on a float, and they're saying, we're Muslim, we're warriors, we're revolutionaries, right? You don't see that kind of thing with the belly dancers and the Habibas in southern Brazil, right? So it's a protest, it's a protest form that you're seeing.
All right, so clip two, go.
Somos negros, sudaneses. Somos negros, muçulmanos. Somos negros, guerreiros e revolucionários.
So I don't know about anyone else here, but I'm ready to just clear off everything and just have a samba party right now. So one main argument within your book, which I really enjoyed reading and found very fascinating, is that you talk about how Muslim youth today, in trying to proclaim identity, protest, build community, aren't really looking towards Islamic thinkers so much as they're looking towards African American thinkers, particularly those associated with the civil rights movement, like such as Malcolm X is a big one. And you talk about sort of the circle with that, because then you also have the civil rights African American leaders during that time looking towards Islamic thought, and this cycle, this circle that's actually very, very interesting, and so where was my note? Of understanding identity politics within narratives of social justice. So how is this explored and expressed through music, particularly through artists that we'll be seeing coming up, such as Loki?
Well, regarding the Black Freedom Movement, I've had this ongoing debate with Oliver Roy, who's a French scholar, well-known scholar of Islam. And he wrote a book called Globalized Islam about 10 years ago. And his argument is that with the end of the Cold War, there is no left anymore. There's no narrative for social justice anymore, right? He says when the Cold War was still ongoing, if youth felt militant or angry or rebellious, they become socialists, they become communists. Today, with the end of the Cold War, there's no communism, there's no socialism, people become Muslim. So every political malcontent in Europe or America converts to Islam, right? I said, Habibi, not quite, right? That's not quite true, right? This, if anyone modestly familiar with the history of minorities in the West, Jews, European, history of Jews in Europe, or Africans in the Americas, this attraction to the Muslim world, to Islamic history and theology, goes back 100 and something years, right? So I wrote an article in response saying, you know, you need to look at this, and so on. And then he says, actually, yes, but this conversion, minorities converting to Islam, this is a very American thing. It's very local, It's not local. It's very international, actually. You know, there's such a thing as a black Muslim internationalism. And what I say is that if you look around, and I've been talking to Muslim youth activists, one question that often comes up is, why is there no left, right? Where's the Islamic left? If you look at the Muslim political landscape today, it tends to be dominated by the right. You have the Salafis on the far right, the Muslim Brotherhood center right. If you're a liberal, you gravitate towards Sufism. But why is there no left-wing movement? Why is there no Islamic left movement, right? There are left-leaning thinkers, right, from Ali Shariati and Hassan Hanafi and so on. And so what I say is that that vacuum today is filled by the Black Muslim Archive or by the Black Internationalist Experience. Muslim kids today, Muslim youth who are looking for a narrative of social justice, a narrative that speaks of empire and racism, inequality and U.S. foreign policy that links the local with the global, tend to gravitate towards the African-American experience. This is not just Muslim youth, right? In many ways, the only narrative of social justice that we have today are the black freedom struggles of the new world, right? But for Muslims in particular, given the Islamic influence and given the Muslim presence and given the role of figures such as from Marcus Garvey to Noble Drew Ali to Malcolm X, sort of civil rights activists, black freedom fighters, who made it a point to throw cultural and political bridges to the Muslim world, they created an entire archive, right? Literature, arts, politics, texts, that Muslim youth today are tapping, right? Are reviving as a way to enter the West, as a way to become indigenous to the West, so to speak. Regarding hip-hop, right, regarding low-key, so I talk in the book about sort of the cultural intermingling between Islam and African-American music, right, Islam and American music, right, and it begins in the 20s with jazz and, you know, jazz internationalism and jazz and Pan-Africanism, and then the State Department would try to use jazz to respond to Soviet propaganda. And then you have R&B and soul absorbing all kinds of influences. You have groups such as Earth, Wind & Fire and so on, and Kool & the Gang and The Moments and so on. But it's hip-hop, really, that absorbs some of the most Islamic influence. And there are a number of scholars writing about this. There's Saad Kabir, there's Zahir Ali, there's Sohail Dolatzai, who've written extensively about Islamic influence in hip-hop. And what I argue is that this influence, you know, hip-hop does a number of things. Hip-hop in the early 90s, when it begins to absorb Nation of Islam and so on, it introduces non-Muslim kids, regular American kids, European kids, to Islam, right? So it broadcasts African Islam around the world, African-American Islam around the world, right? And to Muslims, and introduces Muslims to black Muslim, to black history, to the black freedom movement, right? So hip-hop is a two-way bridge that disseminates black history and Islam, and you begin to see all kinds of cultural, you know, interminglings coming about, right? And you wanted to jump to low-key?
Well, because low-key, you know, he references Malcolm X. And so how is this addressed through some artists such as Low-Key? I mean, there are other hip-hop artists also who also reference.
Right. So you begin to get references to Malcolm X and American hip-hop in the early 80s, right? And then the 90s, you get 5% or Nation of Islam influence. And in the 90s, with the rise of the Salafi movement, right, you get some very interesting, again, interactions where you get, hip-hoppers who discover Salafism and leave hip-hop altogether. Think Napoleon, who was part of Tupac's crew, who now travels the world, who's a rapper turned Salafi, right? Who speaks out against hip-hop and how hip-hop, you know, is corrupting and so on. He's an example. Another example is Loon. But you also get movement in the other direction. You get hip-hop absorbing Salafi influences, right? The mustacheless beard, the short pants, all kinds of influences, and in language as well. And you get rappers such as, so you get Sufed Out hip-hop artists sort of influenced by Sufism, hip-hop artists influenced by Salafism, and you get this artist that we're about to see. Anyone heard of Low-Key? Yeah, Low-Key is probably the most popular rapper on the transnational Muslim youth scene today, right? A British Muslim artist who is an anarchist, right? He's avowedly an anarchist. He's not particularly devout or religious, at least in his, you know, you don't see that in his lyrics. And what he talks about is he gives voice to sort of the anti-state sentiment that you see in the European urban periphery, that you see in the European ghetto, right? Sort of suspiciousness of of states, an opposition to state policy, and a rejection of the states in favor of a larger, broader transnational identity, whether it's a Muslim identity or a Pan-African identity. And in this video, he's taking on, you know, the question that scholars address: what's terrorism? What's the definition of terrorism? And he's, you know, why is state violence not considered terrorism? So in the video, which has gone 3.5 million hits, I think, he's in prison, it's Guantanamo, he's being interrogated, and Malcolm X appears to him. And Malcolm X is a recurring figure, right, in these cultures. And Malcolm X appears, you know, Loki's there studying the dictionary for the definition of terrorism. Malcolm studied the dictionary when he was in prison. And so you see this interaction, right? We're playing the moderate bit for you, by the way.
So clip three, go.
So, we must ask ourselves, what is the dictionary definition of terrorism? The systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion. But what is terror? According to the dictionary I hold in my hand, terror is violent or destructive acts, such as bombing, committed by groups in order to intimidate a population or government into granting their demands. So what's a terrorist?
They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terrorist. When they put it on me, I tell them this, I'm all about peace and love. They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terrorist. Insulting my intelligence, oh how these people judge.
It seems like the ragheads and packies are worrying your dad, but your dad's favorite food is curry and kebab. It's funny, but it's sad how they make your mommy hurry with her bags. Rather read the sun.
I remember a year ago at Aslan Media, we wanted to do a mixtape around Martin Luther King Day, and so I was, you know, contacting these hip hop artists, you know, in Middle East, Muslim, Middle Eastern hip hop artists. I asked him, I said, so do you have any tracks that were inspired by Martin Luther King? And pretty much all of them wrote back and said, no, but here are two or three that I've done that were inspired by Malcolm X. So yeah, he's very much a theme. So looking at that, I wanted to contrast it with the next clip you wanted to play of state-sponsored hip-hop. Well, not state, but, you know, by artists who are sponsored by the state as a way to combat, you know, Salafism, but also, in a way, I guess, sort of control the narrative in a safer way to control, I guess, the Islamic narrative in a safer way.
Any of you watched the show Tosh.0, Comedy Central? So I feel we're doing. Play a video, then comment, play a video. let's take a few minutes from the video, take a break. In terms of state sponsoring music, what I talk about is how after 9/11, a number of governments discovers Sufism, right? And they begin to mobilize Sufism, so-called mystical branch of Islam, right? It's quite striking, right? This is an idea. Sufism is somehow being more compatible with liberalism, more compatible with the West, more accepting of modernity as an old colonial idea. It goes back to the 18th and 19th century. This idea would be introduced by European Orientalists, European scholars of Islam, into America after World War II. And back then they were saying what the U.S. should do as it deploys across the Muslim world, it should back Sufi brotherhoods, right? Sufi brotherhoods are softer, more tolerant than the Islam that's coming out of the Arabian Peninsula, right? They weren't very convincing. It was the realists who won that debate and who decided that the U.S. should support political Islam against communism, socialism, and third world nationalism. But after 9/11, the debate surfaces again. Right, and you have neoconservative scholars such as Bernard Lewis, who in the early 50s was making this argument that the US and Britain should talk to the Sufis, as he would say, talk to the Sufis, right? So one way to respond to the Muslim Brotherhood, the Wahhabi, Iranian Shiism, Khomeiniism, and the Salafi movement coming out of Saudi Arabia is by stirring up folk Islam, local Islam, Sufism. This policy would be adopted in dozens of countries, really. And at the heart of this policy was the idea that, again, Sufism is local, it's indigenous, it's folk, it's a folk Islam that's, you know, and it's not as violent as the Islam, as the political Islam, the Islamist movements coming out of the Middle East. And at the heart of this policy was music, right? Music policy, cultural policy, given that Sufis have long been tolerant of music as opposed to Islamists, Salafis, Wahhabis, and so on. The idea was use music, right, to disseminate Sufi Islam and use Sufi practice to disseminate liberal Islam. So a number of countries, starting with the United States, would begin investing in Sufism and backing Sufi organizations. The Nixon Center, RAND, would produce reports in 2003 about the need to support Sufism, Sufi brotherhoods, the need to stir up disagreements between folk Islam and political Islam, and so on. And the Pentagon would create a program, a $1.3 billion program called Transforming Islam from Within. And essentially, it was delivering money, right? Delivering aid to organizations deemed moderate and Sufi, right? So this policy would be adopted by the Bush administration, by the Blair government. The Blair government would actually create a British Sufi council to counter the more conservative, the more recalcitrant British Muslim Council, Muslim Council of Britain, which was opposed to the war and so on, right? So this was policy. It would be adopted in parts of West Africa, in Algeria, in Ethiopia, in Chechnya. The idea that Sufism is the way to check the globalization of Salafism, right? Sufism is a useful way. And it plays out in music. Many of you may have heard of the group Junoon, Salman Ahmed from Pakistan, Pakistani-American. Junoon was a protest group in the 90s, right, in Pakistan, right? They were protesting against Islamist groups that wanted to ban music, and they were mobilizing against Nawaz Sharif, who was in power then. And they emerged at the first group, and Salman was a guitarist, rock. You know, he would create this idea of Sufi rock, right? He very much believed, separate from the state policy, right, that one way to respond to Wahhabiya, Salafi movements and so on is through music, right? Sort of by mobilizing Pakistan's indigenous, quote-unquote indigenous, you hear this term often, repertoire of Qawwali and so on, incorporated into music and then use the guitar to broadcast that, right? So he was very popular. You know, when then Musharraf came to power, Musharraf would embrace him. After 9/11, Salman Ahmed of Junoon becomes the face of Sufi rock, right? He performs at the UN and saying the response to what's going on to the clash of civilization is Sufism, Sufi rock, and al-Rumi, right? Rumi, the poet. The UN would declare 2007 Rumi Day. They would declare, you know, they would celebrate his 800th birthday. And so you begin to get this state-sponsored music, right? In Britain, in Pakistan. Musharraf would set up a Sufi National Council, a Sufi Advisory Council, setting up festivals across the country. And Salman and Junoon would be the face of this. So you have these groups sort of going out, playing music and so on. And eventually what I talk about is a counter-movement develops, mm-hmm. right? The Taqwa Corps, you may have heard of them. The Kaminas in particular are a group that came out in response to sort of the conservative Muslim denunciation of music, as well as government efforts to sponsor Sufism, right? And the Kaminas are a fascinating group. American kids, raised between Lahore and Boston, right? And their music, and they become quite popular, they perform around the world, is a response, right? They come out in responding to the Salafis who hate music, so they get thrown out of ISNA, Islamic Society of North America here. They play their guitars at the convention.
Very provocative song titles.
Yeah, very provocative song
Great
titles.
Lyrics.
And also, they start, you know, they write for The Guardian, going off on Musharraf. I mean, who is Musharraf? A man who suspends the constitution, right, allows for drone strikes, you know, an autocrat, to be mobilizing the country's treasured Sufi repertoire for whatever purpose it may be, right? And there's a wonderful book on Pakistan called Pakistan, a Hard Country, by Anatoly Levin, 500 pages, and he talks about the folly of this, right, of sort of dropping drones from above while backing Sufism below. So this was Sufi policy, and at some point in the mid-2000s, 2006, 2007, before Obama came to power, the U.S. would begin to shift back to working with groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood. Sufism is good for public relations, cultural diplomacy, and so on. But if you want people who control the streets of, you know, whatever, London or Paris or so on, or Karachi or Cairo, you're better off talking to the Islamist organizations. So there's a retreat from this Sufi policy. So to set up this clip. Mm-hmm. And every European country, I would say today, I'm exaggerating, most Western European countries today, there's a debate over who, what's a good, you know, the cultural establishment is debating which hip-hop to support, right? In Germany, there's a debate right now around Desso Dog. Anyone heard of Desso Dog? An intriguing character. He used to perform with DMX. Then he became a Salafi, drops hip-hop, starts doing a cappella vocals, and then now he's somewhere in Syria fighting, right? So there's him. In Germany, and sorry, in Holland, there's Saladin. And the governments are trying to decide what kind of hip-hop to let into the mainstream, right? Given that hip-hop is so heavily influenced by Islam, it's so popular among Muslim youth, it's so popular among all youth, and this is where many youth hear things about Islam, what kind of hip-hop should we let into the mainstream? And this debate is particularly playing out, particularly poignant in France, because France is very active in the arts, right? They have a very active interventionist cultural policy. People in France, French government officials, speak openly of a hip-hop policy. What hip-hop policy should we adopt, right? And so in England, Loki is sort of the bête noire, right? No racial overtones, right? He's sort of the person who's marginalized, not played on radio stations, and yet he's embraced by the underground, he's embraced by the youth. In France, the counterpart to Loki is a gentleman by the name of Medine, right, who's a French Algerian rapper, similar themes, history of imperialism, history of colonialism, Malcolm X, Black Panthers, very influenced by the Black Power movement. He has a thick beard. He calls it the Afro underneath my jaw. And he gets he doesn't get much mainstream play, right? But the French establishment has embraced his rival, right, his adversary. Maybe that's too strong a term, but his counterpart, his analog, and that is Abdel Malik. Right? And Abdel Malik, as you'll see, is a French Congolese convert to Islam. He was a very popular rapper as a youth. He used to rap with New African poets. And he was sort of a street hustler, used to do gangster rap, got into trouble as a youth, became an Islamist, joined the Jamaat Tablighi, which is a South Asian group that's active in Europe. And then he has a transformation about 10 years ago and becomes a Sufi. Right, so after that, he doesn't really do rap. He doesn't do sort of, you know, hard instrumentals that he used to do. He does more chanson française, spoken word with jazz riffs. And his books, he's immensely popular. He's written book after book. He's written a book called May God Bless the Suburbs, May Allah Bless the Ghetto. And it's all about how there's not going to be a clash of civilizations in France. They're not going to be, you know, the ethnic riots that happened in 2005, that's not going to lead to a major disruption in France. Islam is compatible with secularism. Islam is compatible with the French creed of laïcité, égalité, and so on. And he has won every award imaginable from the French cultural establishment, right? And this is a clip that he did called Gibraltar, where he's talking about how he's no longer an angry black youth, right? He says the angry black youth of 10 years ago is today filled with love and reconcile different civilizations. And Gibraltar represents sort of the transculturation that's taking place between North Africa and the West and Europe. And you know, he goes out of North Africa a lot because he's part of a Sufi brotherhood there, right? And he married a Moroccan R&B singer, but that's another.
All right.
So this is Abdel Malik.
So clip 4, go.
Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, il y a un jeune noir qui prend vie, qui chante, dit enfin « je t'aime » à cette vie. Puis les autres le sentent, le suivent, ils veulent être or puisqu'ils sont cuivre. Comme ce soleil qui danse, ils veulent se gorger d'étoiles et déchirer à leur tour cette peur qui les voile. Détroit, Gibraltar, il y a un jeune noir qui n'est plus esclave, qui crie comme les braves, même la mort n'est plus entrave. Il appelle au courage celles et ceux qui n'ont plus.
So there's an entire tangent I could go down asking you questions about narratives, state versus...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I can't. This would be fun. But actually...
So just to say one more point. Abdul Malik is a great artist. He's a tremendous poet. I used to love his stuff, you know, and I still like his work. But ever since he's been embraced, right, by the French government and the French cultural establishment, he's lost the street, right? He's lost his street cred. He's being pitted. You know, they're pitting him against, you know, sort of more militant rappers, against Tariq Ramadan, who's seen as a voice of the hard left, Muslim left in France. He's gotten into debates with Ramadan. And it's a snapshot into the dilemmas facing young Muslim artists, young activists in Europe and America. Right? How do you deal with this state? Do you want to be embraced? If you get embraced as a moderate Muslim, right, that's a good thing. You get invited to the White House or the Elysee and so on. But you lose the base. Right? Moderate, you know, I talk about, you know, in the book about sort of the politics of, you know, of calling a Muslim leader a moderate, right? That's often the worst thing you can call a Muslim leader, because as soon as you call him that, you know, it simply means in the Muslim community, it's a top-down racial term. It means compliant. It means you do as you're told. And so on. So these hip-hop artists have, you know, not just the artists, but youth activists, when they're approached by embassies in Europe, when they're approached by the State Department, they have to take some risk. They're cast in, these are 23, 24-year-olds cast into these diplomatic roles, right? If you're in Marseille, if you're in a suburb of Birmingham, and the State Department shows up, U.S. Embassy, and says, okay, here, we'll offer you, whatever, £10,000 if you work with us or you make this track saying this, do you do it or do you not, right? If you do it, it opens up doors. You know, all kinds of doors. But not just that, I mentioned a kid in Berlin who told me, he says, look, I know full well if we work with the embassy, you know, then I'll show up at a Palestine rally or a rally, some issue, you know, other people will tell me you've sold out, you have no credibility. But being embraced by the U.S. embassy spares us the surveillance of local authorities. If the American embassy says we're moderate, quote unquote, then the French, Belgian, and so on, local police leave us alone. Right. So there's some very difficult questions. I'm not denouncing the kids who decide to do it or not. I'm just trying to air the conundrum, right? It's very difficult. Relationships, you have to negotiate a relationship to the nation state that you're living in, relationship to the Islamic movements and communities in your city, and then to the US as well, right? Because the US can often, you know, bypass these other actors.
So like I said at the very beginning, this book actually like what we've talked about tonight has just scratched the surface of the complex relationships between state policy, politics, youth movements, urban disillusionment, Islam, just lots of different things within this book. Also, too, within different genres we haven't even covered tonight. The jazz section I found very fascinating, coming from a more classical music background. Fortunately, we don't have as much time to go over tonight. I did want to open up the audience now to questions they might have for Dr. Aidi regarding what we talked about tonight.
Already?
Yeah, it went by that quickly.
I wanted to show the Midioni video.
I was hoping at the end.
Is Maureen here?
Yeah.
Can we show
we can show it?
Thank you, Maureen.
Okay, great.
let's show both videos.
Okay, so one is one I find just really, it's very funny, of the diplomat rapping. And the other one, I guess, after we show it, the Maury one, if you could talk really briefly about sort of with him in his unique music style, about how it's not just, this book doesn't just look at these points of, I guess, negotiation or contentions. It also looks at points of encounter and how these points of encounter create brand new genres as well.
Right. So the clip, two last clips. The second to last clip, one of the things I talk about in the book is every security expert, it seems, a national security figure, terrorism expert, has something to say about hip-hop, right? These days, there's an entire school of thought in the foreign policy establishment that thinks hip-hop can be mobilized for de-radicalization, cultural diplomacy, and so on. And so you see, you know, you have figures, political scientists, international relations theorists who are commenting on, you know, Flo and Bling and the politics of cool and Kendrick versus Lupe. And it's really quite astonishing. And then there's this deployment, France, Britain, Germany, and the U.S. deploying hip-hop, man. So this, you know, deploying it for cultural diplomacy and de-radicalization and counterterrorism and so on. And it's comparable to the deployment of jazz in the early 50s. Jazz was supposed to represent inclusion and sort of the improvisational quality and diversity of American democracy. Hip-hop was supposed to represent protest, right? It's supposed to represent sort of the fire of Malcolm X, as one scholar put it. And so you have establishment figures talking about hip-hop. A friend of mine runs an NGO in Berlin. He does hip-hop pedagogy, working with, you know, immigrant youth and so on. And he says the American ambassador came for an event. This is a former Goldman Sachs exec, comes for an event, you know, grabs the mic, talking to the youth, and he starts talking about Tupac being one of America's greatest poets, right? And then he starts to flow, the ambassador. He starts sort of reciting lyrics of, you know, and I really wanted to find this footage to show you of how, you know, American diplomats have embraced hip-hop. I couldn't find it, but a student of mine sent me this clip of the American ambassador to Laos. And see for yourself.
So clip 5, go.
Toy me jai makak. Tim Panta don't it. Top hip hop right. To infancy. The Faja pick. The Saija mine. Then Pisces sir. Tantu rap die. My name Tantu. Sir Karen Stewart.
We had to show them.
Yeah.
Just to set up the last clip, I dedicate the book to two people who helped me with the research. The first one is Randy Weston, who is a jazz pianist. He lives in Brooklyn, was born in 1928, I believe.
Who are you going to depth with about?
Right, and I talk about how the influence of jazz ambassadors, how jazz would go from the U.S. to France and then percolate downwards to North Africa, and how it would alter the cultural and musical landscape in North Africa, right? Musical genres such as Gnawa, which were marginalized, would be embraced by the jazz musicians. And 50 years later, this genre, which is what you were hearing when you walked in, by the way, is one of the most popular sounds of North Africa, right? So, you know, I dedicate the book to Randy Weston. And the other figure is also a pianist, Maurice Medioni, who was an Algerian Jewish jazz pianist from Oran, Algeria. And he's also born around the same time. They're contemporaries, right? And the stories they tell me are very, they're talking about American diplomacy, American empire, and so on, from two different perspectives. Here's this North African gentleman and this Brooklynite African-American. But Maurice Medioni, he was a young boy in Oran, Algeria, when Vichy came to power, World War II. As a Jew, he would be taken out of school, stripped of his French citizenship, and he would be basically playing at his uncle's cafe, playing the piano, playing Andalusi style, which is what he was trained in. 1942, the U.S. launches Operation Torch in November 1942. Troops land in North Africa, and I'm very interested in the American landing and how that would change North African and Middle Eastern music. But they land in North Africa, and Maurice Medioni is playing at different bars at his uncle's restaurant, and he bumps into these Latino soldiers, Puerto Rican soldiers, right? And they teach him how to play rumba and ragtime and boogie-woogie and so on. And he tells me, when you play Andalusi, Nuba, you play with your right hand, Maghrebian music. The left hand doesn't move, right? But he noticed that these people were playing with their left hand. Rumba. They were playing with their left and their right. So he learns to play with his left hand, rumba, Nuba with his right hand, and he incorporates both into a genre called Descarga Oriental, which is sort of mixes Cuban rumba with Andalusian Nuba, right? And it leads to this wonderful, you know, culture, musical genre, which is today seeing a revival. I can't go into reasons why it's seeing a revival, partly because of Muslim-Jewish tensions in Europe and so on. But Maurice Medioni, who's a close friend, and I talk to him often, he was working as a part-time musician for decades. He was a tailor, right? He's a full-time tailor. After the Jewish exodus departure from Algeria in 1962, he moves to Marseille, and he's a tailor playing bar mitzvahs and so on. And then in the late 90s, he enjoys his rebirth. So now at the age of 88, he is touring the world with a group called El Gusto. And really quite astonishing story, right? And there's a film and DVD about El Gusto done by my friend Safinaz Bousbia, who's an Algerian filmmaker. But this is Maurice in his own way telling you how, you know, with the American landing, how he met these American GIs.
So clip six, go.
America goes to war. Men of the Army, Navy, and Marines reinforce the battlefronts on six continents to save the homes and ideals of free men from Axis domination.
Ils buvaient beaucoup de whisky, ils buvaient de la bière, ils buvaient, quand ils étaient sur... When Irish eyes are smiling... Hey, boy, hey, play with me. You know, la cucaracha, you play with la cucaracha. They were drunk. They were sous. It was an ambiance terrible. And there was on the piano, the patron, he m'avait vu un plateau. And I gagnais bien ma vie. And un jour, il rentre un soldat noir américain. Il était debout à côté de moi. Il m'a regardé jouer. Il me dit, "Can you let me your piano, please?" For sure. Yeah, why not? Et je l'ai vu jouer du boogie woogie. Ça, c'est le... J'ai vu cette main gauche jouée par ce noir. J'ai dit, quelle merveilleuse musique. Il ne m'a pas appris, mais je le voyais jouer. Je rentrais à la maison, j'imitais tout ce qu'il a fait.
This clip is from an upcoming documentary about Midouni. Small trailer.
If the Lamont School of Music is watching this video after it goes up online, I'm putting in my formal request to bring this guy.
Yeah, he played at the Skirball. He played at the Skirball, yeah.
Go ahead, sorry. Yeah. Can imagine. So let's open it up to questions from the audience, if anyone has any. Just raise your hand and they'll come to you with the microphone.
Thank you so much, first of all, for coming to speak, both of you. Hisham, I met you very briefly at the Manning Marable Memorial Conference a few years ago. I'm here with actually some of my students from Islam and the West at USC. So this is the section they're about to go into. And what we deal with in the class are questions of representation historically and in the contemporary moment of Muslims in the Western world and vice versa. So this is sort of, I guess, two brief related questions to the issue of representation. The first is that often I think Muslims in the West are so desperate for representation that, you know, there's this kind of rhetoric, and I'm sure many in the room can identify with this, where it's like, oh man, did you hear Dave Chappelle is Muslim now? Like he's, you know, our new, we're gonna adopt him into like the fold. And so I want to, ask in a way without obfuscating very complicated histories, but on how potentially the task of representation that's heaped onto Muslim artists and musical artists from the street, per se, does to politicize Muslim youth around issues of race in particular. And then the second is hip-hop and Palestine and how that has sort of, and the vice versa, sort of engendered newly revived conversations around Palestinian liberation in the African-American community in particular. Thank you.
On the question of representation, yeah. I mean, they are bearing a burden. And to conflate the two questions, I was very surprised to see Shadia Mansour, right, who's one of the biggest figures in Palestinian hip-hop, right? This is an English She's British Palestinian, raised in London and so on. Amazing flow, only raps in classical Arabic. She did a trailer as a British ambassador, cultural ambassador, right? So I'm wondering what her thought process was, because the trailer that she did is very much at odds with the lyrics of, you know, of occupation and struggle and so on. But I think she also calculated that, as with many, right, that doing this can either help placate Islamophobia a bit back home, gain some kind of concession from the British government. So it's difficult. Yeah, it is a difficult calculus that they have to go through. And I think it's very positive what hip-hop is doing in terms of, you know, connecting with the African-American experience is a very positive thing. Yeah.
Bam went through kind of a similar thing when they did a video with the UN women's.
Who did?
Dem.
Oh yeah.
They did that video against honor killings and came under some harsh criticism because they did it with it was a part of the UN project.
Right. So they came under harsh criticism from who? From well-known anthropologists.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah, for selling out basically.
Right. So this is what I'm talking about. Leila Bulughd, you know, well-known scholar of gender in Islam. You wouldn't expect her to hold forth and debate Dem, right? And she wrote an article, you know, telling them, you know, critiquing what they did and only talking about internal factors, not talking about external factors, and talking about the honor killing, right? But, you know, everybody's paying attention to hip-hop.
Yeah, to develop the question that was just mentioned in regards to representation, if you observe the current status of hip-hop music here in the United States, you actually notice that a lot of hip-hop artists like Snoop Doggy Dogg or Tupac or Eminem, they tend to be less politicized and have less of an activist agenda and are actually more affirmative of mainstream capitalistic materialistic cultures. Whereas you mentioned that in Europe, for instance, in France, the government is actually more affirmative and assertive of the subaltern politically counterculture that exists in the hip-hop scene, which is also the case in Germany even, and in most European countries, and especially in the Middle East. So I'm kind of wondering to what extent there's possibly an opposition between Christianity and Islam in regards to that political positioning, and to what extent there are also socioeconomic factors involved that may encourage or even sort of bully a lot of African American hip hop artists to be more affirmative and less politically activist, politically concerned and involved. So, that's sort of the question is sort of in terms of that, if there's possibly sort of a strong opposition between the two religions that define the political positioning.
I haven't seen sort of Islam versus Christianity hip-hop battles. What I have, I mean, to talk about your question about corporate hip-hop and bling hip-hop and so on, the French government is not worried about, you know, the bling. You know, they're not worried about sort of the neoliberal, guerrilla capitalist hip-hopper. They're worried about, you know, Americanization and Islamization, which is why the French government in 1994 passed a law, the Carignan Law, restricting the amount of U.S. hip-hop that could be played on the French airwaves, because they were worried about English terms entering the French language, right? And ironically, in blocking out American hip-hop, they actually created space for banlieue hip-hop, hip-hop from the French ghetto, which tends to be largely Muslim, right? So for in France, the anxiety about hip-hop revolves around two things, about Americanization and Islam, right? But you were talking about the conscious hip-hop. In writing this book, people don't ask me about T-Pain and Wheezy and Snoop Lion or whatever his name is now. People ask me about the 90s, the early 90s stuff. I was in Sao Paulo last summer during Ramadan. I came across a hip-hop collective called Posse Hausa, right? And they were deeply invested in early 90s hip-hop, whether it's, you know, Rakim, Poor Righteous Teachers, and so on, the Muslim-inflected rap of that era, right? So that rap may have disappeared from the mainstream here, but it's still, it's still very resonant in other parts of the world. And it's used as a way for these lyricists and for the youth to represent, you know, their politics and their racialization. You were talking earlier about race and representation. One of the things I argue is that you're seeing a turn towards race, right? This, you know, this deep interest in the Black Freedom Movement and the African diaspora that you're seeing in Muslim communities is a result of racialization, right? It's an interest in issues of race. It's a response to the range of punitive policies that Muslim communities have been facing for the last 10 years, right? It's not a coincidence that all of a sudden Iranian Americans, Arab Americans, Afghan Americans are pushing for minority status in the census, census form, right? That's the political, that's a political expression of racialization, but you're seeing it in culture as well, right? And it's a response to what's going on, right? It's a response to this a decade of war on terror policies.
Any other? Oh, yeah, there's someone. Oh.
Hopefully I'm not going too off question on this one, but out of curiosity, I understand the BBC did an interview, I forget the name of the band, but they're from Lebanon, and a two-part group, they were LGBT identified, at least one of the singers. And sang
Mashalela?
About, maybe, that might be the one. In terms of sexual orientation in the LGBT community, is there any outpour or growing number of them within the Muslim world or outside? I know when I visited Montreal and there was a group there I visited a few years back, but it was slim pickings for me in that respect.
I'm not aware of an LGBT cultural or musical trend, but there are groups that are actively supporting gay rights, such as the Caminos. Right. Mm-hmm. The Caminos came out against a number of Muslim leaders who were opposed to gay marriage and did a track on Old Rumi and so on. So there is that, right? Mm-hmm. You're seeing, I mean, what you're seeing in the music, right? You remember there's a book published some years ago called Noise by Jacques Attali, a Frenchman, who says music, you know, music tells you what, you know, music gives you a taste of social change before it occurs, right? Music changes before social structure changes. And I think in music, you can see a number of the political and intellectual trends that'll reach the Muslim community institutionally in some years, I hope, right? And this is one issue, right? And another issue is feminism, right? This field is still male-heavy, male-dominant. It's still dominated by men, right? I quote an anthropologist in Belgium, Faye de Lastry, who says, European hip-hop, the guardians of European hip-hop, right, are Muslims. Right? The guardians, the Muslim, the artists tend to be Muslim, right? He says, and the problem is they're all men. Mm-hmm. They're largely men, right? So the more you get artists such as Shadia Mansour or Diem in France, the better.
So an automatic stamp of authenticity in hip-hop used to be being underground, but now because of technology, people are questioning whether there's some benefit to still remaining that way. I was wondering if you could talk about how technology has changed rebel music and how it's impacting niche messages to be translated across oceans and across the world.
Yeah, what exactly is underground? I'm not sure. I'm not sure I know anymore, you know? Medin is considered underground, but he sells very well, right? But he's not played on mainstream radio stations, right? So technology is crucial. Technology has, you know, were it not for technology and YouTube, Loki and Medin would not exist.
A lot of these guys.
What's that?
A lot of these guys
would not exist. Yeah. Were it not for technology, when the revolt began in Egypt in Tahrir Square, it was through technology that Narsi and Omar Effendim and Freeway, you know, uploaded their track, hashtag January 25th, in honor, right? So technology has completely revamped this. And, you know, Chuck D says, Chuck D's completely left record labels and does, you know, through rap station, he releases his tracks, You know, he says technology is the way to liberate ourselves from the shackles of record companies. So I see it as a good. However, I'm not really a 100% cyber optimist because states and governments can use those very technologies for surveillance, right? And I talk about this. The U.S. has a very vibrant digital diplomacy program, right? Using Facebook, Twitter, and hip-hop, right? To liberate, to stir up revolts and so on. And of course, last summer, we find out that those very technologies are used by the NSA for, you know, to hoover up data, right? So, you know, technology can be used in any direction, but in hip-hop, it's undoubtedly a positive form for these artists.
Essentially become their representation. Many of these guys don't have official right. representation.
Sure. I mean, what, you know, what agent would take on Low-Key?
No.
Yeah, it's the truth.
I'm curious if you could talk a bit about Orquestra Nacional de Barbés because of the particular style of bringing this North African sound to Paris, but you know, people were outraged, and you talk about this in the book.
Yeah, it was one incident that I describe, right, which is having a jam session right after Futur and Ramadan, right? Right after you break fast, they're in a restaurant jamming, men and women dancing until Fajr, until they get ready to fast again. But Orquestra Nacional de Barbés is interesting because they represent sort of the arrival of Gnawa music into the mainstream, right? And Gnawa music is this is a Sufi community, Sufi brotherhood in Morocco that's linked, that's long been associated with West African slaves. Largely, you know, one of many Sufi brotherhoods that would be marginalized after the, you know, once the country gains independence. The reason for that is the colonialists mobilized Sufism and Sufi brotherhoods and suppressed sort of, you know, reformist Muslim movements that would link to the Middle East, right? So after, so with independence, these movements get marginalized. 50 years later, right, these movements surface again, these Sufi brothers surface, and Gnawa becomes the most popular because of its links to jazz. Jazz chose Gnawa, that's what I argue. And Orchestre National de Barbès is the first group in France that would sort of bring this Gnawa fusion into the mainstream. But the music they do is Gnawa mixed with all kinds of other music, right? It's about fusion, right? And there's a lot of talk of fusion these days, right? Sort of as a response to Islamist, the Salafi and their emphasis on purity and pure politics not being corrupted by other cultures, artists are mobilizing. They're saying, well, we actually believe in being mixed musically and culturally, and our music represents this. Orquestra Nacional de Barbès does this very well, right? And they would help mainstream Gnawa music in France, you know, introduce all these French youth and what North African music is, you know, the mixedness of North Africa. But then they too, you know, meet a critique coming out of North Africa, people saying, you know, enough of this all fusion talk, right? Be more political. You know, fusion is sort of liberal multiculturalism. We're diverse, Benetton, hey, we all get along, right? Where's the critique in all of this, right? But they're still popular and their work is amazing, right?
Just kind of ended, we were talking about fusion just now. I guess one of my favorite quotes in the book is actually from Weston, who was one of one of the people you dedicate this book to, where he was talking about the term fusion in music, and he said, I'm not sure about the term fusion, all this talk of fusion. It never made sense to me. What I was doing was a conversation, a dialogue between different parts of African music. And that really, I liked that quote a lot. You know, to look at it as not just this melding of, you know, we're all going, you know, it's all going to come, you know, together in this, I guess, not, I don't want to say muddle, but, you know, this becoming one. It stays, you know, these different traditions, these different genres, they maintain their own identity and they have a dialogue with each other. Once again, yeah. Encounter.
Yeah, the discourse of diversity can be used to exclude, mm-hmm. right? I mean, is it Angela Merkel, Tony Blair? No, not Blair. Cameron, mm-hmm. and Sarkozy would all declare multiculturalism dead. Multiculturalism is dead, but we are diverse, mm-hmm. right? So if diversity becomes a way, sort of a token multiculturalism, you have, you know, black and brown mm-hmm. faces and so on, and the inequality remains, the surveillance remains, the oppression remains. And so what you have, these groups pushing back against this liberal talk of diversity and multiculturalism, mm-hmm. right? And it's playing out in music.
So I wanted to thank everyone for coming to join us for this conversation. I also wanted to thank the LA Library Foundation for having the both of us here.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.